Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
You know, I was living in Atlanta. I was thinking a lot about the roots of Southern cuisine in ways that had never been talked about in my family. And I was like, well, geez, like this seems like a lot of the same ingredients or, you know, cooking practices that I saw my dad do or that I, you know, that I remember, you know, some of these flavors. And so in an effort to do that, I was thinking about, you know, West African chefs and, you know, could I find Nigerian food in Atlanta? And so that essay kind of explored that.
This week, sitting across the table from me in CDM Studios is none other than the brilliant young writer Osayi Endelin. Her writing about food and identity in Southern Foodways Quarterly, Gravy, has earned her the James Beard Journalism Award. You'll find her work north and south, from the Wall Street Journal to the Washington Post and Atlanta Magazine. And most important to my heart is her contribution to an anthology entitled You and I Eat the Same, on the countless ways food and cooking connect us to one another. That's where she wrote an important, evocative, and should I say fattening piece on fried chicken. Welcome, Osayi, to Special Sauce. We feel privileged to have gotten you here on one of your infrequent trips to the Big Apple.
Oh, I am so happy to be here.
It was such a pleasure to read everything I could before seeing you, because, wow, man, you just can write your ass off. So good. So good to be here.
I'm going to download this when it airs and, like, just keep that on the loop somewhere when I'm feeling all the pangs of the first draft. Thank you so much.
Sure. So since you write so frequently about food and identity, our usual first riff on Special Sauce is particularly pertinent. And that riff is, tell us about life at the Endelin family table.
Well, gosh.
Growing up.
So I was born and raised in California. And I spent some time in the Bay, and then a period in the Central Valley, and then the rest of my childhood was in the Inland Empire, and I went to college in Los Angeles.
I love the Inland Empire. I noticed that. Like, what area is the Inland Empire? Is it like Sacramento?
I don't know Sacramento that well as an adult. I would say maybe it's you're going to have all of your various ethnic groups without all the, like, glitz and shine of Los Angeles to a certain degree. So that's where you've got, like, you know, Riverside, Moreno Valley,
got
where
it.
I went to high school, San Bernardino. I don't know if Pomona quite counts, but, like, you know, going out toward, like, Claremont.
Yeah,
you know,
Pomona counts.
Yeah, so.
Like the San Gabriel Valley, like the other side of the mountain.
That's on the other side.
Got it.
So okay. We're going a little further east. And
got
it's an
it.
Area where I think a lot of people don't realize California has places like that.
Yeah, for sure, because everyone goes to Los Angeles and San Francisco, maybe Santa Barbara or Santa Cruz.
Right, and then when they go to those places, you know, they go to the ones that, you know, become those destination spots on all the, you know, the movies and shows
and
things like that. So for the early part of my childhood, I would say what I remember most is, you know, my mom's cooking was, I would call it, like, maybe California working mom cuisine, where, you know, you've got sometimes you had, like, noodles and tofu. Sometimes you had roast chicken and roasted vegetables. Sometimes it was just, you know, one pot spaghetti with the sauce from the jar, a lot of frozen veggies with the medley. I always remembered, like, the
medley,
lima beets.
I just love the medley. The idea of the vegetable medley is something we don't talk enough about on Special
Sauce. Yeah, I mean, I don't miss it. But, you know, it was, we had really balanced meals. There wasn't, I totally appreciate that picky eaters is a thing and that it's hard for a lot of parents. But in my household, that just wasn't, it just never came up. It wasn't an option.
Got it.
So we just ate everything. My father cooked sometimes, and when he cooked, he made Nigerian dishes. He was Edo. He was from Benin City. And so there were a lot of dishes that I don't really have names for now, but, you know, they were essentially stews, or depending on your household, you might call them curries, right? You had your base, you had a meat, it sat for a while, and he would serve it with eba, steamed yams that had kind of been pounded, so kind of like pounded yam, but It's a little darker variety. Rice a lot. Sometimes we had boiled plantain. I preferred the sweet plantain fried rather than like the
right.
the less ripe plantain that was kind of more like almost. And sometimes he would roast it. And then I remember a lot of social events that were hosted by either my father or people that he knew in kind of a very close-knit Nigerian community, both in the Bay Area and in Clovis, where we were living, which is next to Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're familiar yep. with Cal State Fresno. And so those events would have dishes that he never made, had a lot of preparation to them, like moi moi, which is a... like black-eyed peas, you know, grinded down and kind of mashed and steamed with peppers and onions. And they're steamed sometimes in foil or banana leaves. When you take it out, it kind of looks like a little mold. So, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of call it like a Nigerian tamale.
Right.
Sometimes you have like hard-boiled egg pieces in there, or meat chunks in there. I remember egusi soup, which is a favorite of mine. And, you know, you'll see that on a lot of menus of African restaurants that might be labeled as such, but, you know, a goose. And that's a stew that I think you'd find in other cultures along the same regional area as well. But it's a bitter melon seed, and you've got, like, crayfish in the base, and usually had, like, stewed chicken or goat in there, too. We'd have akara, which is also made out of shelled black-eyed peas, you know, seasoned maybe with some onion, salt, and pepper, and fried. So it essentially looks like a hush puppy or, you know, a fritter.
Right.
And so I really loved all that food. And when my parents divorced when I was a teenager, we moved further south to Moreno Valley, so from Clovis to Moreno Valley. And my grandmother was across the street. That was delightful because for so much of my childhood, she was always like, returning home, or we were always like leaving her, and all of a sudden now she was like right there. So we would have a lot of Sunday dinners at her place, and you know, she'd make your typical baked fish, and sometimes she'd make maybe like a roast, and you know, some kind of cornbread dressing.
And this was your mother's
mother? My mother's mother, yeah. Yeah.
And she was from the South?
Yeah. So her name was Ruth Rushen, and Ruth Harris Rushen. She was born and raised in Laurel, Mississippi. Her father was a Methodist preacher, and her, you know, her mother basically took care of, I think there were five of them. They had a small farm and some animals, and she went on to college, Clark College at the time, in Atlanta, and then worked for a little while in D.C. And she was at the Labor Department kind of right after the war, and learned on her first day. She was sitting next to a young white woman, and she was so excited. This is, you know, the first day on the job. And, you know, she asks what job the woman has. And whatever the woman tells her, my grandmother realizes in that moment that when they came to her school to give, like, the aptitude tests and the interviews, the job this woman had wasn't even something she had been eligible to apply for. And so that kind of begins to, like, set her in this sense of, like, you know, being in a small town in Laurel, kind of insulated. Mm-hmm. She didn't really have a lot of day-to-day experiences with Jim Crow and racism. Of course, you know, looking from a more...
like 10,000 feet.
Yeah, from like the forest view, you could see the divisions. But in her life experience as a child, she didn't necessarily have that othering feeling. And that became very present for her in D.C., you know, shopping for hats and, you know, people wouldn't wait on her and things like that. So she spent only a couple of years in D.C. before she decided to move to Los Angeles. I think she already had a cousin that was out there. And, you know, that's how it went, you know, right?
Yeah.
You heard somebody else had kind of made their way, so you went. And she worked in the Methodist church as a receptionist for a little while. And she had a brief period cleaning homes. She had this great anecdote of being asked to look at the, please address, like, the dust pearls underneath the bed. And she was like, I don't know, you're going to have to tell me what you mean by that, because she had never heard that phrasing before. And it wasn't long before she got a referral to a job in social work.
Wow.
And it was from there that she really kind of found her vibe. And she went from social work to probation. She was appointed first woman, I think, and definitely, you know, first African-American to sit in California's parole board. And then she went on to serve as the director of corrections under Jerry Brown's first term.
Wow, you really got to write a book about
her.
Okay, can we just stop the whole thing? And we're just going to spend the rest of the time talking about your grandmother.
Well, so she didn't cook a lot for my mom and my aunt because she was up and down from L.A., where my aunt and mother were born, to Sacramento and all that. They had an extended family. They had a relative who came up. They called her Annie. And that's spelled actually auntie, but it's they pronounce it Annie. And I think she was, I always get this wrong, but she was on my maternal grandfather's side. And so she did a lot of the house, you know, kind of
right.
care for them. But so when I was, you know, a teenager living across the street from her, that kind of like day-to-day cooking, you know, dining opportunities, we could, you know, go over and hang out with her.
You come from a remarkable family of women between your mom and your grandmother. I can't imagine all the things, like when she got that job for the government, that there were too many other African-American women that had similar positions.
No, and she was, you know, I think very early on got a reputation for being really fair, but being really straightforward. You know, later in her career, she was, you know, getting a lot of awards when I was younger. And I just remember people always kind of saying, oh, you know, that Russian, like she's, you know, they'd always have some like kind of shaking their head, like
right.
she checked me that one time, but it was important that she did that.
She was a badass before women were called badass.
Yeah. I actually found on Google Books, and gosh, I hope maybe one day I can get like a digitized version. But Ebony had done a profile of her, Ebony magazine.
Wow.
Maybe this was like 1980 or 81, something like that. And it was this full spread, and they had photographs of her. I think there were a couple of her walking the yard, maybe at like one of those state prisons. It might have been San Quentin. And, you know, those guys had a lot of respect for her because, you know, she listened and she was interested in corrections, not necessarily as a place solely to punish, but as a place to really give people, you know, resources because they're going to reenter, the vast majority of people. It's a, you know, an idea we still haven't quite caught on to yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember this quote that I'm going to have to paraphrase, but, you know, she was basically like, you know, if you're looking for the pushers, you know, that's fine. But you've really got, if you want to stop, you know, drugs being sold, you really have to go to Beverly Hills where the people are buying most of the things that are, you know, that are being. So, you know, I thought that was really, I mean, it doesn't sound revolutionary, but, you know, to kind of call that out.
Yeah, back then.
And to say that back then.
Yeah, think, that's amazing.
Speaks volumes.
You know, you mentioned your dad did a bunch of the cooking before your folks divorced, and you wrote this extraordinarily powerful an honest piece about your dad and going to his funeral in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Tell us about his relationship to cooking and how it affected you. And I was just so struck by, you know, when you said he didn't want anyone in the kitchen and it was obviously a fraught relationship.
Yeah, I mean, my dad had, so his name was Lucky Ehigiator, and people are always like, no, what was his real name? It's like, no, his first name was Lucky. And, you know, he had this really, like, magnanimous personality. I mean, he was just, you know, big smile, like, very handsome. You know, he walked in the room, you would know he was there, just amazing laugh. But he had this really awful temper, and I don't know where that all came from. I know that growing up, his grandfather was very hard on him. You know, he, like a lot of kids do in his home country, you know, he went off to boarding school very early. He was a youngster during the Civil War, the Biafran War in Nigeria. And, you know, that wasn't stuff that he talked about very much. But there was always this underlying tension, you know. But the food was great. The food was glorious. Dinner was sometimes fraught and tense, but the food was really good.
Right.
And when he cooked, I mean, I don't remember him ever cooking what we might consider, you know, your typical like kind of West Coast California fare. So like stuff that you would find like Marie Callender's or the Sizzler or things like that. Like that
right.
wasn't stuff that he was turning
yeah,
out.
He was cooking Nigerian food.
Yeah.
Like
and
described.
And like I hear from some folks that he immigrated to San Diego like barely out of his teens. He attended UC San Diego. That's where my parents met. And I hear that a lot of those guys have to kind of figure out how to cook when they, you know, when they come because it's not necessarily something they were tasked with doing always. And so it's kind of like grappling the recipe. So, you know, I think a lot about migration now and what people bring with them and what they leave behind and how tough it must be to try to recreate something that, you know, felt maybe so inherent to your day-to-day experience. And now you're just barely able to source the ingredients. And maybe you don't even know what they're called in this in this other language. I mean, English is a native language for many people in Nigeria, you know, including my father. But it's still, I think, you know, challenging. So I didn't get to, like, really observe him cook or sort of, like, you know, sit off to the side and chat with him. You know, we were always kind of, and this might have to do with just being a kid and, you know, anytime you're around, it's like, get out of the way, you're underfoot. But I enjoyed the food, the flavors. I wasn't always interested in some of the, I guess what you'd say is that sometimes I think my dad really did not understand how it was he would happen to be raising American kids, right?
Right.
Like, you know, this, the things that would come out of our mouths, it would just, he would sometimes find them so, like, disrespectful, maybe unknowingly, or even just customs that he was used to, like, not eating food with your left hand, you know, that is, you know, your left hand is not considered. And this is true in a lot of African countries, a lot of the Middle East, too. Like, you
wow,
eat with your right hand.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. You know, the left hand is, you know, kind of perceived culturally. That's where you do your business. It's not where you bring to the table. Especially, you know, we think about a lot of communal dining. You know, these customs are important. And, you know, so stuff like that he would get really, you know, turned around by. That just didn't make sense, you know, to me and my then, you know, he was my only brother at the time. We have a younger brother, but it was hard to balance and kind of work out as a kid.
It sounds like also he didn't equate food to love. I once had the late great Dora Ephron on a radio show, and I asked her what food meant to her, and she laughed and she said, "You mean besides love and family?" You know, but it sounds like for your dad, it might have been some of that, but it must have been other things too.
You know, when I would sometimes express to him that I felt like I was an affectionate kid, and, you know, my mom was very affectionate with us, and, you know, she told us she loved us, and, you know, there was always this sense of, like, you know, we knew where we stood, and with my father being such a unpredictable figure, you know, like, he'd lash out and next thing you know you'd be getting whipped about something that you didn't even know what you did wrong. You know, it was hard to not always have, like, the other side of it from him. And so, you know, he felt like, hey, you have a bed to sleep in, you have this nice house at the end of a cul-de-sac, you know, you go to a good school and you've got clothes that fit, what's your problem, right?
Wow.
like you know, I mean,
sure,
and you know, that is where I think, you know, I mean, a lot of people were kind of raised that way. I think he was certainly raised that way. And, you know, but sometimes I think he would vacillate because he could be very tender. But I don't know if sometimes he felt like that was allowing too much leniency.
Yeah,
you know?
Somehow he...
Spare the rod.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
sort of.
That's
like,
weird.
Yeah.
You also wrote a beautiful piece about your mom in the Washington Post, which actually I want to show to my wife because... You talk about that you have to sort of reluctantly conclude that you're like her and that she's like you and that she gets you,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, yeah. and that you did it with using food as the metaphor was really beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Connecting food to love and family, you do it in a way that reflects the complexities contained in the relationships between food and love and family. So talk a little bit about that relationship because I think it's closely tied to a lot of your writing, which is about food and identity.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you got to throw love and culture in there too.
Yeah, that piece was a little hard for me to get started, but once I did, it kind of came like A to Z pretty quickly. And it was really nice working with Joe Yonan, editor of the food section at the Washington Post.
I know Joe is a good man.
He is a good man. And I turned it in and he was like, okay, well, that's a wrap. And I was like, wait, you don't have, like, comments? You don't want to revise something? And so I haven't actually read it again because I'm afraid I'm going to find something that I wish I had changed. Sometimes, and I think a lot of kids who, you know, emerge from households that have experienced divorce in some way, sometimes the parent who's always there sometimes gets a bad rap because they have to withstand all of it. And there's not really the same tag team.
They have a hard time reconciling the good cop, bad cop thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, my mom had a lot of help with my mom's side of the family. But, you know, for sure, like, you know, coming into my teens, it's just a difficult time, right? Like, I'm trying to figure out who I am, and she's trying to figure out who the hell is that? Like, and through my college years, I went to high school in Moreno Valley. I went to college at UCLA. That's, you know, now it's probably about an hour and a half, but at the time you could get door to door in, like, at least the way I drove, you know, 60 minutes.
Right.
But I didn't visit home that often.
Because you wanted to separate.
Yeah. And try to, you know, define. And I had always been, I was one of these teenagers that had always been complimented for being mature.
Right.
And so it's just kind of a dangerous thing, because when you do act age appropriately, people think you're regressing, which
right.
is kind of really
hard. Right, right. And also the mature thing implies respectful. And you don't want, as a teenager, to be identified as someone too respectful.
Yeah. And, you know, being mature in the sense of, like, being polite isn't necessarily the same as, like, having financial maturity or, like, an emotional maturity in some areas. So, you know, there was just, I think, a lot of, like, there was friction. I think it was, a lot of it was normal. But, you know, it made our differences stand out to me.
Yeah.
You know, if you hear my mom speak, you can tell I'm my mother's child. When I, from the time, from, like, 9 years old, if I answered the phone back when, you know, everyone had landlines, I said hello, people would start talking to me like I was Angela. And so I'd have to say, like, you know, because, you know, I have the same diction as her.
My wife has that with her late mother, too.
Yeah.
She had it. It was like they both had these two octave hellos,
right.
and they were indistinguishable.
Right.
Hello.
Yeah. And the more that I sort of charted off this kind of adult life for myself, the more I realized I was doing things that reminded me of my mom, from the way I organized paperwork, you know, how I handled, like, household chores, the way I conducted myself sometimes, you know, professionally, even, like, the way I would get if I was upset in some situations where, you know, my mom can get, like, she gets upset, she can get very, like, quiet and very pronounced, and her words are very enunciated. And I tend to do that. So it's kind of weird to kind of see this coming back around. And, you know, I looked in the mirror one day and I was like, wow, you know, I've had this prominent forehead and, you know, like, this facial structure. My face has changed a lot. Like, the shape of my face has kind of changed a lot as I've aged. And I just, you know, I look more like my mom now than maybe I did 10, 15 years ago. And that's a bell ringer, because I think it starts to, like you said, signify other areas in our lives where, you know, we overlap. And I've always been proud of my mother. I've always, you know, loved her fiercely. But I've also sometimes felt like, you know, we're very different. But sort of accepting that similarity was kind of cool. I think it was refreshing for her, too.
Yeah.
She's like, well, finally, you know, it only took 30 some odd years. Yeah.
And was she a good cook or just a productive cook?
She was a good cook. I always remember enjoying her food, but I just remember, you know, time. Time was a challenge. You know, my mom always worked. She was a journalist in the early part of her career. She actually was pregnant with my brother when she was at Stanford getting her master's in journalism. She was a reporter.
It's
and then
too bad
she...
you come from such a lightweight family here. I mean, what's going on here, man? Oh, yeah, and my brother became president. You know, it's like, what's up with this?
You never know. Yeah, so she moved on into, like, media affairs, public affairs, and things like that. But that work schedule, that intensity of, you know, so she leaned on me a lot when I was a little older, which at times, you know, was challenging for me. But
to get food on the table.
To help out, you know,
yeah.
And it wasn't anything crazy that she was asking, like, hey, you know, start the oven at this temperature and
right.
do these three things.
It wasn't
and
reduce the sauce by.
Right. So I remember, you know, sometimes wanting to, you know, do things on the weekends, like, you know, make cakes and things like that. And, you know, those were always like the one box, you know, add an egg, add a little oil kind of things. Sometimes pancakes on the weekends, that kind of thing. But I think as her schedule started to open up, as we became a little bit more self-sufficient, you know, there were three of us. She could start to be kind of more exploratory and reflective in her cooking and not so much like, okay, I got to get these three food groups on the table.
Yeah. You are often, as I've said, described as someone who writes about food and identity. How did you come to that topic? Like, how did you arrive at like, wow, that's the area of the food culture that I want to explore?
Mm-hmm.
Like, was it by accident? Were you inspired by something you read of someone else's?
Some of that first started when one of my good friends, Evan Ma, was editing Atlanta Magazine. We were both mentees of Bill Addison, who had left that position to go on to Eater.
That's right. Yeah. And now it's on to the LA Times.
Yeah.
I love Bill Addison. He and I have talked for hours about Aretha Franklin B-sides.
Oh my gosh. I'm sure that was a delightful conversation.
Yeah.
And I hope he busted out into songs from time to time. But I had pitched him like three or four stories and story ideas. And, you know, Evan came back and said, you know, I want you to do this one. And one of those pieces was kind of exploring Nigerian food in the Atlanta area, which by that time I had started, you know, when my parents divorced, there wasn't a continuation of Nigerian cooking in my house. I think mostly just out of a lack of skill.
Right.
And then, you know, in the IE, the Inland Empire, there wasn't places that I knew about, at least, that were cooking
Nigerian food.
Yeah, or even what you might consider just West African dishes for a long time. That's changed a lot now. I think that's like on the forefront of the next like kind of American cuisine zeitgeist. But at the time, those were very home-based experiences.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was living in Atlanta and I was thinking a lot about the roots of Southern cuisine in ways that had never been talked about or really referenced in my family. And I was like, well, geez, like this seems like a lot of the same ingredients or, you know, cooking practices that I saw my dad do or that I, you know, that I remember, you know, some of these flavors. And so in an effort to do that, I was thinking about, you know, West African chefs and, you know, could I find Nigerian food in Atlanta? And so that essay kind of explored that. And I was surprised that Evan had gone for it because I remember, you know, suggesting things that were a little bit more on trend and kind of like, this little personal story over
right.
here, like, you know, you don't want that. And that ended up being something that caught the attention of the Southern Foodways Alliance. And from there, I wrote for them and then I came on as an editor and started writing a column for Gravy. And
you should say it's Southern Foodways Alliance Quarterly.
Right.
And that's where I presume you got to know my friend John T. Edge.
Mm-hmm. You know, we'd met in Atlanta around 2014, 2013, I think. But yeah, working on, so just to clarify, it is Gravy. That's the name of the publication.
Right.
But sometimes they have to say Gravy Print versus Gravy
Got
Podcast.
Got it.
Yeah.
Right.
Between that essay for Atlanta Magazine and started the work I was doing at Gravy, I realized like, okay, you know, I'm not a restaurant critic. I'm not someone who's necessarily going to be traveling around like collecting, you know, top 10 lists and things like that. And these were things that I was thinking about more and more. And, you know, I think also on the media side, there's, you know, the last 10, 15 years, it's like been a huge growth of personal essays
sure.
and interest in those narratives. So I think it was a lot of things converging. But for me, in terms of the food component, I felt like if food can actually be this lens from which we can explore so many different things, you know, why certainly it can be something that I can use to talk about my experiences as a child of an immigrant or as, you know, the descendant of someone who was in the Great Migration or as a descendant of enslaved people or, you know, all
yeah.
these other and then these historic and, you know, personal experiences.
But that's the great thing about food and why I have stayed writing and producing stuff in the food culture, because the food culture enables you to touch every other discipline and every other aspect of life.
And I didn't really know that coming into it. I mean, I started really like my first professional clip, I think, in food was another clip for Atlanta Magazine. I was an intern in graduate school at Atlanta Mag, and I had heard this oral history that they wanted to do on brewing company Sweetwater. And they didn't have someone to do it. The person who they thought was going to be able to do it wasn't available. And I heard this in an editorial meeting. And
you raised your hand.
I did not raise my hand, but I cornered the editor
right.
of Steve Hennessy at the time after the meeting. And I told him, you know, hey, I've been, you know, following craft beer culture. I've been, you know, I've had a few like clips in a smaller run monthly. And, you know, he said, well, let me see, you know, your clips and, you know, we can talk about it. And he assigned it to me and he paid me. And, you know, supposedly I'm the only intern to ever earn a feature assignment at Atlanta Mag.
And then I became a food writer.
But that was like, okay, like, you know, this is an area. I mean, I'd been writing, you know, profiles and I'd been doing a lot of, you know, essays and some art coverage and things like that.
Wow. So you're kind of the accidental food writer, but I now, after having read so many pieces of yours, it's like you're one of those voices that from the first sentence, like, oh, that's an Osai piece. Mm. And that's the best thing you could say as a writer. You know, I started as a music writer and I had all these music critic idols and I could write exactly like Robert Christgau or any of these seminal rock critics, but they didn't sound like me. And then when I started writing about food, everyone said, oh, it's kind of like listening to you talk.
Uh-huh.
You sort of found a back roads way to that.
Somehow. I mean, thank you so much. My mom taught me the practice of reading out loud what you write.
Mm-hmm.
I stuttered, actually, for a while as a kid. And between kind of practicing reading out loud, she would help me do that to sort of hear how fast I was. It was because I was reading quickly,
right?
You know, that I would try to stumble over these words super fast, and she'd say, you know, like, you have to slow down. It's like you have to say slower than you hear it or see it in your mind. And between that, and I think just the act of revisioning or revising, if I get stuck or if I'm trying to figure out where I need to go, the best way for me to get there is to read it out loud.
Yeah.
Even if I'm just sort of murmuring the words.
The same thing.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid we have to leave it here for this episode of Special Sauce. But we will continue this conversation for the next episode because we haven't talked about fried chicken and what you wrote about in You and I Eat the Same and the book you're working on and, oh yeah, what you're going to write for us at Serious Eats. So thank you, Osai Endelin, for this episode.
Thank you.
And thank you for agreeing to stick around. And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.